and Fort Necessity, there's a 9-hour battle that takes place in which Peter Mercier and George Washington and his troops, the South Carolina troops, they fight it out with the French and the Indians. And a lot of the South Carolinians were killed, including Peter Mercier. And the end result of Washington's foray into that part of Pennsylvania is it sets off the French and Indian War. Washington loses his first battle that he ever is in charge of. Of course, he then goes on, you know, to become our American general and then, of course, our president. But there's a connection here in the Casey area to that battle that took place up there at Fort Necessity in western Pennsylvania.
You are listening to History Man, the platform for historians, curators, and authors to tell their stories of the American Revolution, walk in the footsteps of heroes, and proclaim freedom reigns. On today's episode, we are very fortunate to have Andy Thomas, the curator of the Casey Historical Museum, and David Brinkman, a local historian and archaeologist, and a commissioner for the Casey Historical Museum. So welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So today's episode, we're going to be talking about the colonial beginnings in the Midlands of South Carolina. And Casey, actually, although it was not Casey at the time, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong, Casey was not the name of this particular area in the colonial times. Is that correct?
That's right. They would have called it the Congaree's. And the reason they would call it the Congaree's, you have the Congaree River, and you also have the Congaree stream or creek that run together.
And this is at it's the fall line that runs through here, which kind of determined a lot of the development. This was as far up the river you could go from the coast where before you started having navigation problems. So a lot developed because of that right here.
I know when we were talking to some of the historians in Camden, Rick Wise, for instance, gave us a background of Camden. And he talked about that same thing. The fall line stopped at Camden, and really, you could almost draw a line from here to Camden as far as the river and where that fall line lies.
That's right.
The fall line was important in the river because the river was the main highway, and I mean, mm-hmm. from a transportation standpoint, correct?
That's right. You can, and actually, you can extend that line all the way over to what was North Augusta, where they put a fort, just like they put a fort here on our river, where the fall line is located.
Okay.
And David's correct. You know, you could put boats on the river here. Now, they would have to be shallow boats, but they could go from here into the Santee River system. And then from the Santee River system, they could come out into the Atlantic Ocean. And so with that, you could also ship goods up the river systems here. So from Charleston, you could bring goods up to the fort, or you could bring goods up to the developing town of Granby. This was a very important part of why this area became so important during the colonial period. Is part of it is the river. You've got the river that you can ship goods back and forth from the ocean, but you can also follow the river if you're walking the river. So if you're a Native American, you've got a convenient landmark that will, if you follow the river path, you know, it'll lead you to the coast. You're following it up into the Piedmont. That's another thing that you can do, understanding directions and knowing where you're going. The other thing is, because of the fall line, you've got rocks in the rivers, which is going to make it easier for people to cross these rivers.
Right.
And finally, the fact that you've got Piedmont cultures to the north and you've got coastal or low country cultures to the south, this kind of becomes a natural meeting point between those two cultures. Whereas like in Native American times, they could bring salted fish or salt or shells this way. From the mountains, you'd get river cane or you'd get mica or other materials from there that you wouldn't find, you know, in this part of South Carolina.
It's a very phenomenal area in that regard when you think about the joining of different cultures in the southeast. Where was the Cherokee Path? Did it run through here as well?
The Cherokee Path did run through here. It started at the lower towns of the Cherokee, which are located up in or near Wahala, Seneca, Clemson, that area. It followed a path that took it through the area that we know is 96. And then from 96, that path continued down here to the Congaree's. Once it got here to the Congaree's, it would then continue a little east and then down into Charleston.
Okay. So you had a land route kind of coming into this area, and the navigational routes on the river all coming into this this area. Mm-hmm. So when the Europeans arrived, what would they have found?
Well, Europeans, when they first came up from Charleston, they were looking for trade with the Native Americans.
Okay.
And so they would have found a small groups of Native Americans in the backcountry in Piedmont of South Carolina. These Native Americans could be a couple of villages, or sometimes they were a little larger. One of the groups that we know about is the Congaree. And obviously the Congaree is the name that gives its name to the river. The Congaree, though, just like other Native American groups, would move up and down the rivers. But we know about the Congaree when they lived a little south of here, because we had an Englishman, John Lawson, who visited 1701, and then he wrote a book, I think it was 1711, called A New Voyage to Carolina. And he actually visited both South Carolina and North Carolina. But he gives us a little tantalizing snapshot of the Congaree Indians. He talks about them raising cranes. And those cranes would have picked the feathers off plucked the feathers off the cranes to use as decorations. They also used them to control insects in their gardens. He talks about that they grew a lot of tobacco here at that point in time, and they had these little stone pipes that they smoked it out of. And then he talks about he got invited to the Queen's residence. Her husband was on a hunting trip, and the Queen served John Lawson mush with dried peaches on top. And mush was basically, it was cornmeal mixed with water, maybe a little salt, and then the dried peaches would have been sprinkled on top of that.
What happened to the Congarees?
What happened to Congarees is the story of the second largest Native American uprising in colonial history. The biggest was King Philip's War up in New England. But here in South Carolina, we had the Yamasee War in 1715. The Yamasee War drew in a lot of tribes in the backcountry. A lot of tribes put their allegiances with the Yamasee, and they rose up against the colonists here in South Carolina. It actually drove many of the colonists behind the walls of Charleston. Charleston was a walled city at one point in time, and they had to abandon their farmsteads. They had to abandon their homes. And these Indian tribes were in the backcountry that were hostile to these colonists. Now, the colonial government quickly assembled militias and armies to fight these Indians. And in one of those battles in the backcountry, the Congaree Indians were involved in the battle, and many of their warriors were killed in the fight. And so the Congaree decided that they would sue for peace with the colony of South Carolina. And they decided that they would move and merge with another group of Native Americans to our northeast, which are the Catawba.
Okay.
And so many of them picked up and they left this area. And that meant that the settled Indians in this area were gone, but there were still two trading paths through here. You mentioned one was the Cherokee path. The other path was the Catawba trading path. The Catawba trading path was, I think in Virginia it's called the Great Trading Path. It's the Okanichee. It's an old trading path that starts up on the James River in Virginia and goes through North Carolina into this part of South Carolina and over towards Augusta, Georgia.
I mean, that is interesting. I know that several of those tribes after the Yamasee War did merge with the Catawba. I mean, we're talking about the Waxhaw tribe, for instance. And I talked to Dr. Bauer in the Catawba Nation, and she spoke of some of those. So where do we go from there?
Well, 1715 was when it broke out, and it really concluded. 1716 was most of the fighting in South Carolina was over, although there were still skirmishes that continued to happen until the 1720s because the Yamasee relocated to Florida, and they made attacks on the South Carolina colony. But that's all in the low country part of South Carolina. Here in the Midlands, in 1718, South Carolina, the colony, decided that because they place the blame on the Yamasee War on the traders and some of the practices the traders had engaged in, that South Carolina would have a monopoly over the trade for a while. And South Carolina actually had the monopoly over the trade for 4 years. And so what they did is they built military forts in the backcountry, but those forts were less of a military nature and more of a trading nature. And so Native Americans would come to those forts, Fort Moore over on the Savannah River, and Fort Congre One, which would have been here in the Casey area. And they would bring their deer skins to those forts, and they would be they would trade for guns, ammunition, blankets, beads, rum, you know, those type of products. And that went on for about 4 years. Fort Congre One was maybe one of the earliest European structures here in the Midlands. It was a small fort. I think it was more of an earthen fort than, you know, some of the forts that you see later that are built here.
Where would that have been located?
Oh, we know exactly.
You know exactly where that is.
So back in the 1970s, when they were planning I-77, the development of it, some archaeology was required. They were actually trying to find Fort Congre One. They went through and started doing where they were planning to do the interstate and discovered actually what would probably be the St. John's settlement of that happened a little bit later on. But that changed the plans for the interstate, what they did find at that time. So the interstate was rerouted, and later on, more archaeology actually found Fort Congre One.
Where? And
so it's found right off of 77. If you come off and head up into Casey, there's a it's being developed now as they call it the 12,000 year history park. It's near a fairly new tennis center that they have just off of 77, and there's trails that go through there. SCENG donated a lot of land they had and actually built the original trails that go through there, and they circle where the fort is. And also this area where we believe may have been the St. John's settlement that formed later on. And this trading, it was a trading post that was
so
there.
So the Fort Congre One, and then the St. John's settlement. Is the St. John's settlement off of that fort?
It developed right off of that fort. So the fort really became a trading post.
Okay.
And that's probably why St. John's. So you also had the Saxe-Gotha settlement, which came along. The original plans for that were in the late 1730s, and that was kind of considered the first backcountry settlement, well, Saxe-Gotha.
I mean, prior to this, I thought Saxe-Gotha was the historically oldest in this area.
The settlement, the fort preceded it a little bit, but then Saxe-Gotha was developed just north of the fort site.
Okay.
And as time went on, that gradually, it didn't really catch on. So you had these people that were coming over, taking advantage of land grants. So you had the Saxe-Gotha town lots, which were small lots. And then you also could get, you know, 100 to 300 acres fairly close by, but spread out quite a bit. And the town lots didn't really catch on. You had some people that were there maybe for 30 or 40 years, but The St. John's settlement kind of ended up forming just south of that. And then you also had Granby, which began forming north of that. There were some legal issues with the Saxe-Gotha land, which may have added to that, why people were going north and a little bit south of that location.
Saxe-Gotha would have been part of a scheme. It's called the Township Scheme in South Carolina history, in which Governor Robert Johnson wanted to put towns in the backcountry. And he envisioned settlements that would have encircled the Lowcountry, protect the Lowcountry, which was the most valuable part of South Carolina, the plantations and all that. And these towns were set up to prevent other Indian uprisings, like the Yamasee War. They could call on these towns to, you know, to be there and fight in the backcountry. But the other thing was to prevent slave uprisings, too. And so Saxe-Gotha was actually, it was called the Congre Township to begin with. Mm-hmm. But then someone ended up and hit on a scheme. There was a small principality on the Rhine River in the Palatinate that was called Saxe-Gotha. And the Prince of Wales had married the Princess of Saxe-Gotha a couple of years before then. And so South Carolina, actually, they sent people over to Germany. They sent them in with German broadsides, and they talked about this colony and recruited people. And they said, come to our beautiful place of Saxagatha in South Carolina. In many cases, they told them, you know, we'll take you there for free if you meet us in Amsterdam. We'll provide you tools and seeds. Sometimes they said that this would be free, or it would be a loan that had very generous terms to it. And so many families did take them up. And like David said, the town itself did not really develop. These Germans spread up and down the river because everybody wanted a piece of the river. That's why I think there was no like central nucleus to this. A lot of these Germans also spread up the Saluda and Broad, which became known as the Dutch Fork because of the German-speaking influence in that area.
So what happened to St. John?
So St. John's, it was actually a church that was in the middle of the Saxagatha settlement.
Okay, so Saxagatha just grew around.
Yeah, so you had all these town lots, and they kind of picked a little church area right in the middle of it, and that did pretty well. And the unique thing about it is they the people actually, as you had African American slaves coming in, they actually let those slaves attend the church.
Okay.
And eventually, now in the Revolution, the British came in and burned the church down.
Oh. Okay.
And you know, so the European settlers decided, well, we're not going to rebuild this. We're just going to go into other churches. Well, the African Americans had nowhere to go because the other churches would not allow them. So they actually kind of reformed St. John's. It was just in the woods where they met many years. And then, you know, many years later, at the end of the Civil War, they still had their St. John's church going. And they actually could buy land then after the Civil War, and they did that, and they reestablished, you know, the physical building of the church, and it is still here today. It's moved down a little bit south. It has survived, so there's a great story behind that. So St. John's does live on. What they found archaeology-wise, and we actually have a survey that shows the St. John's settlement. It was really relatively small. It was like a group of buildings, may have been circled by some type of protective wall or something, because it was built during the time when there was some problems with the, you know, with natives coming in and attacking. But we do have a little drawing of it, and it's right there next to where we found, you know, Fort Congaree 1. So that's kind of the really about the only thing that survived through those years. Fort Congaree 1, it became a trading post. You had Patrick and Thomas Brown, who were Irish people that came here and were Indian traders early on. So they were working at the fort, and eventually they branched off, and Thomas Brown got some land right where Granby would develop. So when we started doing archaeology looking for Granby, we had a pointer to Friday's Ferry, which was kind of the main crossing point right at the fall line. We actually purchased some land where we found this crossing and started digging. And we found a Granby house, which was probably built 1785. But underneath that, we started finding items of the Thomas Brown, the Indian trader, which was unexpected. But, you know, in archaeology, that often happens. You know, things get built on top of other things.
What a great find. So we're talking 17, I heard 1730s at one point, and we're moving up into the French and Indian War and that sort of thing. Can you give me a population idea? How many people we had in this area?
I think it was still small, within the hundreds. Probably by the time you get to Granby after the Revolution, maybe 1,000 people in Granby, but, you know, before that, maybe 500 in the 1740s, you know, as people start to move into this area and settle.
I think that's one of the biggest things that I still have a hard time grasping when we talk about, you know, all of these important backcountry settlements and what a pivotal time in history these places played in the founding of our country. And then you start looking at the population and you go, there was hardly anybody there in the whole scheme of things, especially when you compare it to today's population, some of our smaller cities. So we grew, and we're coming up to the French and Indian War. This backcountry settlement had an interesting history in that, correct?
That's right. So in the 1740s, both Britain and France are kind of vying for control of the North American continent. And we know that both of these countries, who are these European countries, had what they called Indian allies. And here in the South, the British considered the Catawba and the Cherokee part of their allies. And of course, the French also had allies of Northern Indians. And in that period, these Northern Indians were encouraged by the French to come south to attack the Southern Indians, specifically, I think, the Catawba, more so than the Cherokee. And in that, I think it was the year before 1747, James Glenn, who was the governor of South Carolina, sent George Haig, who was a peace commissioner, into this area. And George Haig was supposed to get all these Indians together, the Southern Indians and the Northern Indians, and work out some kind of peace deal. Well, he was captured. And he was taken back to Western Pennsylvania, and they...
Holy smoke!
Yeah, they captured him and took him as a hostage.
Well, they didn't just take him, like, up to Greenville. They took him all the way to Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay.
And I think the story is that at some point, he's an older man. He goes, you know, I can't make it anymore on this track. Just kill me. And, of course, the Indians took that kind of literally because they killed him. And, of course, that got back to the governor of South Carolina and to this guy's wife. And, you know, everybody's worried about these incursions. And so they decide they're going to build a second fort at the Congaree's, and it's going to be called Fort Congaree II. And this is going to be a much larger fort. And it's going to be a fort that... has three military companies in it. It has two ranger companies. These rangers are men mounted on horseback. They patrol the roads looking for Indians that shouldn't be there. And also there's going to be what they call a South Carolina Independent Company station there. And the Independent Company, who wear a red and green coat, they're found in all the frontier forts in South Carolina. This company, it can be called upon by the governor of South Carolina or by the king to do duties for them. And we have a nice little story about this. But I think, David, you want to say something about the fort first? You know, kind of the construction, what you found or what you...
Yeah, so Fort Congaree II, the actual Saxe-Gotha survey from the late 1730s, it actually had a reservation for this other fort. Now, it wouldn't be built until, you know, probably 20 years later. But that was our location. So when we started doing archaeology at Granby, you know, we were aware of this. And we were keeping our eye out because this was only about 1,000 feet south of where we were digging for Granby.
Okay.
And eventually we found a plat which showed Fort Congaree just 2 years after it was built. That was shown on the plat relative to a pond. You know, the thing that stood out is this neighborhood where we're modern day neighborhood built in the 1960s. It has a flooding problem, and the lowest elevation of the neighborhood matched this pond. From that, we knew pretty much where the fort should be, and we actually went to the people's house, and we went to a couple different houses. The first house we went to, we asked them, can we do some archaeology in your front yard? And they said, no, I don't think so. The second house, they agreed. And within 2 hours, we had a team of like 40 people here. It was overseen by the state archaeologist. And within 2 hours, we found features of a palisade wall. So we had located this fort built in 1748, and which really has quite a history as a fort with it. The George Haig, his widow ended up remarrying the commander of Fort Congaree II, who was Peter Mercier. Mercier and a group of his men were called on, and I can't remember the year exactly. Was it
1754.
Yeah. They were called on to help out this young guy named George Washington. He was in trouble is, would that have been in Virginia, that Fort Necessity, or was that?
So what happened is in 1754, the guy Peter Mercier, who was a French Huguenot, but a British Crown subject.
Y'all's faces are lighting up when you start talking about this. It's kind of funny.
This guy was called upon with part of his company to march down to Charleston. And they got on a boat and they sailed to Virginia. And then from Virginia, they marched into what they called the Ohio country. Really, it was Western Pennsylvania. That was their destination. And when they got there, they met a young Virginian who had just been given his first command. He was serving with the Virginia militia. He'd been given these important orders dealing with the Native Americans in an area as well as the French in that area. And his name was George Washington, of course. And he and the men from South Carolina and the Virginians, they built a fort called Fort Necessity up there. And Fort Necessity, there's a 9-hour battle that takes place. In which Peter Mercier and George Washington and his troops, the South Carolina troops, they fight it out with the French and the Indians. And a lot of the South Carolinians were killed, including Peter Mercier. And the end result of Washington's foray into that part of Pennsylvania is it sets off the French and Indian War. Washington loses his first battle that he ever is in charge of. Of course, he then goes on, you know, to become our American general and then, of course, our president. But there's a connection here in the Casey area to that battle that took place up there at Fort Necessity in western Pennsylvania.
I know when you go to a lot of the battlefields and battle sites now, you'll see a placard of the names of the people who either participated in the battle, and most of the times it's the names of the people who died in that battle. Do we know the names of the people who left out of Fort Congaree too?
We just know Peter Mercier and actually Benjamin Franklin wrote a tribute to him.
Is that right?
At the time, yeah. And it's a very nice little piece. Yeah, here, Andy's got it right here.
Somebody read that to me.
Well, it's a tribute that appeared in the Philadelphia Gazette in 1754, and I'm just going to read maybe a paragraph or whatever. So, of course, Peter Mercier was born in Georgia, and so this is what he says. "Sweetly thou sleepest in glory's dusty bed, by all esteemed, admired, extolled, approved, in death lamented, as in life beloved. Georgia, loud sounding thy achievements tell, and sad Virginia marks where Mercier fell. Ah, lost too soon, too early snatched away, to joys unfading and immortal day."
When people come to this museum, what would they expect to find?
So you're going to get a crash course on the history of this area going back 12,000 years. We're going to talk about Native Americans. We're going to talk about the extensive colonial period that we had here. Of course, these three forts figure prominently in it: Fort Congaree 1, Fort Congaree 2, and Fort Granby. We're also going to talk about the growth of settlements like Saxagotha and Granby. And then we're going to explore what happened in the 19th century with the movement of the state capital across the river, the plantations that were located here, the Civil War, including the Battle of Fort Congaree, which took place in February 1865. And then we'll look at the building of our lock system on the Congaree that got past those rapids that we talked about, and people could actually ship stuff all the way up to Columbia and back. We look at the development of Casey, which was incorporated in 1914. We look at the railroads, which were an important part of Casey. Doolittle's Raiders gathered here before they trained in Florida and then carried out their mission against Japan in 1942. Mm-hmm. And we've got a little bit more of 20th century history. So we're very diverse. We've got a lot of history. We do have a really nice selection of Native American artifacts upstairs, 5,000 to 6,000 pieces. They were donated to our museum. A lot of them are from South Carolina, but we've got pieces from all over the country, and we have pieces going back to the earliest Clovis points all the way through the historic period. This museum is a great value. We charge $2 for seniors, $3 for adults, $1 for children under 12, and we actually have free Sundays from 2 to 5 when people can come in for free.
You've got some things coming up in this area that are fairly interesting that are tied to the museum. Tell me a little bit about those things.
Well, we have a an event coming up on April the 1st, which we're really excited about. It's what we call the Colonial Village at Tartan Day South. Tartan Day South is a huge Celtic festival here in Columbia. It goes on for 3 or 4 days. You can check them out by probably Googling it. But on April the 1st, we'll be set up out at the festival grounds, which is at the Columbia Speedway here in Casey, the old Columbia Speedway. And we're going to have what we call a Colonial Village. The Colonial Village is going to have a lot of emphasis on the Midlands as far as the history of the Midlands during the colonial period and Revolutionary War period. David will be there talking about Fort Granby. He has a display. He brings some of his artifacts out. People can come out and take a look at those. We're going to also have some artisans there doing making guns, wooden guns, making weaving, dyeing textiles, brick making, blacksmithing, some of the trades that you would have seen in the colonial period. And some of those, not the blacksmithing, but a lot of those might be hands-on for children and whatnot. Now, there is a charge to get into the event, and you can look that up on the Tartan Day South website.
I appreciate it. Thank you all so much.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.